Following the account of the Tower of Babel, of which we spoke last Lord's Day, the Scriptures return to the ongoing exposition of the development of human civilization after the flood. The major difference in this portion of chapter 11, as opposed to what has gone before, is that unlike the accounts of the families of Japheth and Ham that we find in chapter 10, chapter 11 at this point actually returns to the account of the family of Shem. That is, in chapter 10 you have an exposition of the family of Japheth and of the family of Ham, and those families, having been described, are then dispensed with, as it were. Then there is, at the end of chapter 10, a brief account of the family of Shem. Now in chapter 11, after this narrative of the incident of the Tower of Babel, we come back to the family of Shem. And in this chapter, the exposition of the history of Shem's family delivers much more detail than anything of which we read concerning Shem's brothers. If you go and you look at chapter 10, at the account of the families of Japheth and Ham, you will not find anything like the detail that we find here. You won't find, for example, a description of the periods of time that were involved in these lives. It is apparent that in this difference, the Spirit of God meant to distinguish the descendants of Shem from those of Japheth and Ham for a specific reason. We find that reason when we get, as we will in due course, to the final verses of chapter 11. And then, obviously, the opening verses of chapter 12, really outside the scope of this series. Shem, we read in chapter 10, was the father of all of the children of Eber. You read that in chapter 10, verse 21. Who is Eber? Well, the significance of that description is that the children of Eber would include Peleg. And from Peleg, if you remember, Eber had two sons who are noted in chapter 10, Peleg and Joktan. Peleg was so named because in his days was the earth divided, probably a reference to the Tower of Babel. But it was from Peleg and not from Joktan that would come the line of descendants that would lead to Abraham, to Isaac, Jacob, Judah, and so on. From Judah would come, from his line, ultimately, Jesus, whom many supposed was the son of Joseph. But they supposed wrongly, because Jesus actually was the Son of God manifested in human flesh. This section of chapter 11, then, that we have read, provides the indispensable link between the world immediately after the flood and the coming of Christ. Some millennia later. It must be counted as remarkable that through all the generations that followed the flood, that link was never broken. Think of all of the potential for the breaking of that link. Think of the potential for the breaking of the link following the Tower of Babel. Think of the potential for the breaking of that link in the time when the children of Israel were in Egypt, thinking of the potential for the breaking of that link in the journey through the wilderness to Canaan, the potential for the breaking of that link in the campaign of conquest, then in the time of the judges, the periods of revival and apostasy and judgment. Think of the potential for the breaking of the link and the dividing of the kingdom. And in all of the upheavals that took place during that troubled history. And what then of the collapse of the southern kingdom and the captivity in Babylon and the aftermath? My, at any time, you would think that link would be broken. That line would be broken. This line did not always appear in the firstborn son of his father. In the case of more than one family in the history of the people of God, the line with which we are concerned today went through a son who was not the firstborn. And Jacob, the grandson of Abraham, is a prime example. Yet we are to remember this evening that God's purpose, here's the thing I want to drive home, God's purpose was governing every development through the history that is reflected in the passage that we have read together. God's purpose was governing that history. In the case of Jacob and Esau, we read in the scriptures that it was God's purpose that the elder would serve the younger. But the truth that we must observe is that this line never disappeared. When we think of these first 11 chapters of Genesis, as we have been doing under the theme of gospel bedrock, we must be impressed that even the genealogies are part of that witness to the gospel, that witness to the coming of the Redeemer. That is, even the genealogies present gospel truth to us. They are part of the inspired word. In this section of chapter 11, this genealogy presents to us the reality, then, of the Redeemer's persevering line. The Redeemer's persevering line. Generation after generation after generation, that line goes on. What you must never forget when we read a passage such as we have read this evening, is that we find recorded here the names of actual people. People who were born, who spent time as children, who became adults and who lived in this world, who looked at the same sun that we looked at today, the same moon, the same stars, although perhaps in a slightly different arrangement as we do. These are people who knew what it was to love and to laugh. They knew what it was to fear and to weep. They knew what it was to mourn. They knew what it was to bury their family members. We know very little about the circumstances that surrounded their lives. But we know that they were, as we are, sinners, born in a totally depraved condition, inheriting from their first father that ruined nature that was the legacy of his original sin. We know that, as is the case with us, those people of whom we have read had only one hope for eternal life. And that was through faith in the promised Redeemer. That was their only hope. This passage is a tribute to the doctrine of divine sovereignty. In every generation, the Creator makes the distinctions that have to be made according to His eternal decrees. And those distinctions have to do with the difference between heaven and hell. That Shem should be the one through whom the Messiah would come did not imply that the other brothers were somehow less worthy than Shem. Why Shem? It did not imply somehow that Shem was more righteous than the others were. After all, they had all ridden in the ark of safety. The choice of Shem, like that of Jacob so much later, was the choice of God. It was without reference to any actions taken by anyone. It was not capricious. It was not arbitrary. It was the result of God's eternal decree. It was a choice then that was devoid of any foundation in human merit. Can we understand that? It doesn't matter whether we're talking about relative human merit or not. It was a choice devoid of that foundation. So then, it is altogether proper that we should address the content of the passage that we have read in terms of the operation of that sovereignty. And I want us to emphasize that in our consideration of this passage this evening. I want us to consider three aspects of that sovereignty. First, sovereign declaration. The purpose of God by this time in the history of the world was well established. That purpose has its roots, of course, in the famous words that we find back in chapter 3 and verse 15 in the aftermath of the fall, where the Lord said to the serpent, "And I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed. It shall bruise thy head," that is, her seed shall bruise thy head, "and thou shalt bruise his heel." This was the purpose of God, to send the seed of the woman to be the redeemer of sinners. That purpose, of course, was reasserted in the words that God spoke to Noah and to his family following the flood, when he reasserted his covenant with them, that he would no longer destroy the world with water as he had done. So that everything that God commanded through these chapters that we have been considering was focused on that purpose to bring the Redeemer into the world. And I submit to you, we cannot understand Genesis at all unless we see it in that light. The bringing of the Redeemer into the world. God had made a declaration that there would be a way of salvation for His creatures that would be unique. It would not be one among many. It would be by itself. It was a way of salvation that would appear ultimately in the entrance of Christ into the world, even though many centuries were yet to pass before that event would happen. death would not render this declaration void. In the civilization that followed the flood, as was true in that before the flood, people tended to live a long time, although you observed in our reading that the lifespans were shrinking as we were going through the generations. Was the result, no doubt, of more and more solar radiation reaching the earth? What led to the decline of lifespans? Although when you read of people living 230 years, I think we would still consider that a very long time. It's interesting in this passage, and in fact it's one of the facets of the passage that is different from the genealogy we read in chapter 5, where you read that refrain again and again, and he died. So all the days of his life were so many, and he died. In this passage, you do not read that refrain, and you do not have any summation of the number of years in the individual's life. So we don't read anything about the deaths that occurred in every generation, but certainly those deaths are implied in the language, are they not? When you read, for example, in verse 11 that Shem lived after he begat Arphaxad 500 years, and then what? Obviously, he died. So that death was the common companion of all in the world after the flood, as it had been before the flood. One after another, the descendants of Noah. And as we saw, Noah himself ultimately, but one after another, the descendants of Noah found their final resting places in the ground. They were put back into the ground. And as God had said to Adam, they were taken out of the dust, and to dust they would return. And so they did. But in every one of those deaths, and in every one of those burials, there was being asserted the truth that God would bring his purpose to pass. As the generations marched on, that purpose to bring Christ into the world was not being lost. All these people died. Shem died. Arphaxad died. All the others died. Ultimately, even Abraham would come to die after living 175 years. But in spite of all these deaths and all these generations, God's purpose was still moving forward. That's why I say it is a sovereign declaration. God is not hindered by the deaths of people. He is not hindered by their unbelief or their defiance. His purpose is going down the track. And that is an encouragement to the people of God today. You may look about you in despair at times and wonder what has happened. Where has God gone? And you may hear the taunt of the devil as the psalmist himself heard it. The heathen say, where is your God now? Why doesn't he do something now? Through all these generations that came after the flood, no doubt that was the taunt that the devil was whispering in the ears of those who claimed they believed God's declaration. Well, he said this a long time ago and nothing has happened. God is sovereign. He is sovereign when it comes to your life. You may never live to see the true fulfillment of all of God's purposes, but God is sovereign in your life, and he has his purpose for your life going down the track. sovereign declaration. Let me come secondly to sovereign designation. Interesting, is it not, that in this list of names, we have the indication that God had already determined who the ancestors of the Redeemer's human nature would be. Already determined. Now, I say that, and I urge you to remember that as this history unfolded, people were not conscious of this designation in every generation. And yet it was there. When we speak about this designation, obviously we're speaking about the doctrine of election. God has made choices. And if there's one thing that depraved creatures hate, it's that doctrine that God makes choices without consulting with the creatures, without giving them input. God's not interested in your input. He makes choices according to His own good pleasure, and He always does that which is right. In these designations, as we have said, they may not always have been the firstborn children in their families. You see, that's the way the world would think in those days. The firstborn child, he must be the one to carry the line with him. That's what Esau thought. And how Esau schemed, even after he frittered away his spiritual heritage, how he schemed to get back what he realized he had lost. Esau thought he deserved it as the firstborn, but God's designation has nothing to do with what depraved sinners think. God's designation has to do with the ones through whom God has purposed to bring His Son into the world. And you can go down the line in this passage and read of them in generation after generation. These were the ones God had designated. We learn here then that God reserves to Himself the right to make eternal choices. And I want to drive that lesson home again this evening. God is over us all. There is a notable passage in the New Testament that we must consider speaks of this sovereignty. Romans chapter 9. Romans chapter 9. We're going to read beginning at verse 14. The immediate context is that very quotation of which I was speaking earlier, where the Lord said that the elder would serve the younger. But I want to read beginning at verse 14. What shall we say then? Is there unrighteousness with God? Translation for people today, is God unfair? Is God unfair that He doesn't give everybody a chance? What does Paul say? God forbid. For He saith to Moses, I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. Now I'm going to have to resist the temptation that I'm feeling to stop and speak about every one of these statements. But here is God asserting His sovereign prerogative, irrespective of anything that His creatures do. God is saying, I am the one who makes the choices. I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. Here's the conclusion that Paul makes in verse 16. So then, it is not of him that willeth, nor of him that runneth, but of God that showeth mercy. The showing of mercy has nothing to do with creatures. It has to do with God and His purpose. Notice verse 17, for the Scripture saith unto Pharaoh, even for this same purpose have I raised thee up, that I might show my power in thee, and that my name might be declared throughout all the earth. From Pharaoh he withheld saving grace. He required Pharaoh to act. Every creature must act. But in Pharaoh's case, there was no grace shown to him. So he acted, hear this, as he wanted to act. You see, people look at the scriptures that say God hardened Pharaoh's heart, and they say, well, what could Pharaoh do? How could God blame Pharaoh if God hardened his heart? What God was doing there was simply requiring Pharaoh to act according to his inclination, which was wicked and depraved. Verse 18, therefore hath he mercy on whom he will have mercy, and whom he will he hardeneth. Thou wilt say then unto me, why doth he yet find fault? For who hath resisted his will? Here's the attitude of the depraved soul. Well, how does God blame me, who's resisted his will? Notice the response in verse 20, nay, but, O man, who art thou that repliest against God? Shall the thing formed say to him that formed it, why hast thou made me thus? Hath not the potter power over the clay of the same lump to make one vessel unto honor and another unto dishonor? What is being emphasized here? God is in charge of his creatures. They are not in charge of God. Now let's bring it down, this sovereign designation. Let's bring it down to where we live. You ever ask yourself why you are the way you are? Ever ask yourself why you are made the way you are? Why your personality is the way it is? Why your body type is the way it is? Why your interests are the way they are? You ever ask yourself that? It is because God's purpose was served by the way you are made. And it is the duty of God's creatures to say, it is your will, and to submit reverently and humbly to that will. What can we know about this sovereign designation? We can know what the people of whom we have read had to know. And that is the truth of blood atonement. We can know that the way of salvation is open through the blood of Jesus Christ. The call of the gospel is not a call to those who think they have been designated. But there are a lot of people that sit around saying, well, I don't know if I'm designated to respond to the gospel. That's not the call of the gospel. The call of the gospel is the call, come to Christ. Remember the words of that hymn we were singing before the message? Not the righteous. Not the righteous. Sinners. Jesus came to call you a sinner. He came to call you. That's the call of the gospel. And it's a call, I say to you, to come to Christ with the assurance that when you come, you will not be turned away. What was it that Jesus said? Him that cometh to me. It's a great text. All that the Father giveth me shall come to me. Ah, there's a statement of sovereignty, of divine purpose. But let's remember the other side of the text as well. Him that cometh to me, I will in no wise cast out. And what is the Scripture saying? Over and over again, there's that call, is there not? Come! Come! You come to Christ, He will not cast you out. There's a sovereign designation. God is saying, Shem is the one. And then He's saying, out of Shem's sons, Arphaxad is the one. And out of Arphaxad's sons, Selah is the one. And so on down the line, till we come to Abraham. Abraham had two sons, but what was God's purpose? Not in Ishmael, but in Isaac. The seed of Abraham would be called. Isaac had two sons, Jacob and Esau. They were twins. They were born at the same time. Esau a little bit before Jacob. But what was God's designation? Jacob will be served by Esau. Jacob had 12 sons. What was God's designation out of the 12? Was it Reuben, the firstborn? No, not at all. It was Judah. Yes, Judah, who was himself a reprehensible character. Yet, out of Judah, this was God's sovereignty. This was God's grace on display. Out of Judah would come, ultimately, the person of Christ. And that leads me to the third thing that I would point out. Sovereign manifestation. We come now to the end of the passage. And what do we realize when we come to the end of the passage? We realize we're coming at the end of this chapter to one of those major transitions in history. Transition in the history of the world. The transition from chapter 11 to chapter 12 in Genesis is a major one. For having laid down the bedrock, if you will, in these first 11 chapters, we read at the beginning of chapter 12, now the Lord had said unto Abram. God is now going to deal with Abram, and now we enter into a series of accounts, of narratives, of the life of Abraham, and the life of Isaac, and the life of Jacob, and the life of Joseph, that will take the rest of the book of Genesis. Why, the Scriptures are going to be focused from this point on one dominant theme, and that is the coming of the Redeemer. The first manifestation that we see in this chapter is the birth of Abram, later to be known as Abraham, because it would be through Abraham's son, his only Isaac, that the purposes of God would develop. In Isaac would Abram's seed be called, not in Ishmael. Now, did Abram always believe that? Apparently, he did not. Because there came a time when he listened to the voice of his wife, who said, I'm not going to have any child by you. I'm too old. It's not possible, biologically, for me to have a child any longer. So here, take my handmaid, take Hagar, and you have a child by her. And so he did. Now, did Abram's unbelief, did his failure to trust in what God had said, did that mean the purpose of God was going to be derailed? Absolutely not. Did it mean that Abram had bought himself a whole lifetime full of misery? Absolutely. And the world is still reaping that misery to this very hour. But God's purpose was not in Ishmael, but in Isaac. So it was in the birth of Abram then that this purpose of God would be manifested. God is sovereign. And one of the great consolations when we come to this portion of the Scriptures is to recognize that however it must have appeared, and remember when the people were living these times, it wasn't a clinical thing with them where they said, well, we know that the line is going to persevere. No doubt there were many occasions in those generations when there was reason for despair, when there was reason for wondering what was happening. But the line was persevering. And when I say it was persevering, it wasn't persevering because the descendants of Noah got together and said, you know, somehow we've got to just keep it going. I don't know how we're going to do it, but we've got to keep it going. God was responsible for the perseverance. Just as He is responsible for the perseverance of the saints, the perseverance of His people. They don't just grit their teeth and say, well, we're just going to keep going somehow. We don't know how, but we're going to keep going. God is responsible because He is sovereign. So in a genealogy, such as we have read this evening, there's cause for us to be encouraged. God is over us all. And in our generation, His purpose is still moving down the track. Let that encourage you not only tonight, but tomorrow. Tomorrow, there's the rub. Back into the midst of all that is about us in the world. The memory of the Lord's day fading away. But let us remember this. God is over us. And He will see to it that His purposes will be brought to fruition.